Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today, we're taking a deep dive into the federal news update for Monday, September 15th, 2025. I'm Alex Johnson, your guide for this exploration into Washington's inner workings.
And I'm Sam Kennedy, ready to help us connect the dots, dissect the nuances, and really get a handle on what these developments mean.
So over the next, say, 20 to 30 minutes, we're going to take a really comprehensive, granular look at the U.S. federal government's actions and activities since the beginning of September 10th, 2025. We'll dissect each move, look at the implications across the executive, legislative, and judicial branches. Think of this as your shortcut to understanding the currents shaping Washington right now, all those fascinating details that often get overlooked.
Yeah, and this week it really feels like Washington is wrestling with this tension, you know, between pushing for rapid modernization, policy shifts, and the traditional ways things are done. We're seeing it everywhere, from digitalizing benefits to totally overhauling defense tech, and often, you know, with some surprising impacts on you, the citizen, and definitely on the federal workforce itself.
Absolutely. So let's kick things off with the executive branch. They've been incredibly busy driving a lot of this week's activity. They've been setting policy, engaging in some, well, pretty high stakes diplomacy. Let's start with those presidential statements and proclamations issued between September 13th and 15th.
Right. And these, they aren't just formalities, you know. They serve a real purpose in communicating what the administration cares about, shaping the public story. Like, there was a proclamation honoring the memory of Charlie Kirk. He was a prominent conservative activist who died in a shooting. That's a significant gesture, right? Acknowledging and sort of affirming the administration's political base.
Yeah, a clear signal there. And then we also had the more maybe routine ones like Patriot Day 2025 and Overdose Prevention Week 2025.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But even those, these seemingly ceremonial acts, they often point to deeper political or social priorities. Some are standard annual things, yeah. But focusing specifically on Charlie Kirk's memory, for instance, that's a direct message to a specific group, reinforcing shared values. For you, watching these helps you kind of grasp the nuances, the administration's agenda, see who they're talking to.
Okay, moving to something more substantial. Published on September 15th, the continuation of the national emergency regarding Ethiopia. Now, Sam, some might just see this as, you know, bureaucratic paperwork, but there's more going on here, isn't there?
Oh, absolutely. This is actually a really significant action. It keeps a long-standing policy in place. This emergency, it was first declared way back on September 17, 2021. That was the previous administration, Executive Order 14046.
Yeah.
And the reason it's still going, persistent, really serious human rights abuses in Ethiopia. We're talking credible reports of war crimes, extrajudicial killings, ethnic cleansing.
Right. And the original declaration called it a threat to U.S. national security.
An unusual and extraordinary threat, yeah.
Yeah.
Because of the potential to destabilize the whole Horn of Africa region.
So if it started 4 years ago under a different administration, why continue it now?
Well, it's actually required by law. The National Emergencies Act mandates an annual review and renewal. Otherwise, these things just expire. By continuing it, the administration keeps the legal tools it needs to apply pressure, both diplomatic and economic, mainly through IEPA. That's the International Emergency Economic Powers Act. Allows for sanctions, freezing assets, that kind of thing.
Okay.
But what's really insightful here, I think, is the continuity. It shows this particular foreign policy stance towards the region crosses party lines. And this continuity, it kind of reveals a growing bipartisan reliance on these executive emergency powers. It lets them act without maybe going through a full congressional debate on long-term policy. Raises questions, you know, about democratic accountability in these ongoing interventions.
That's a really critical point. It's not just the policy itself, but the tool they keep using. What does this long-term reliance on emergency powers mean for stability, especially in a place like the Horn of Africa?
Well, it signals a consistent long-term commitment to addressing those human rights and stability issues, no matter who's in the White House, which, you know, offers consistency, but it also highlights just how persistent these challenges are and how much the U.S. leans on these executive powers to manage them. It can make it harder to maybe pivot or try totally new strategies down the line. For you, it means the U.S. keeps this framework ready to ramp pressure up or down as needed, but it's operating within these kind of established, maybe even institutionalized boundaries that can be both a strength and, well, a limitation.
Okay, let's shift to that high-stakes diplomacy. Secretary of State Marco Rubio was in the Middle East, specifically Israel, from September 13th to 15th, and the timing here was pretty charged.
Incredibly tense circumstances, yeah. This visit happened just days after an Israeli airstrike in Doha, Qatar. It targeted Hamas leaders who are involved in ceasefire talks. That strike killed several people, and basically blew up the negotiations. And President Trump, he publicly said he was not happy about it, which created this, you know, visible split with Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu.
So Rubio walks into that situation. What were the stated goals of his trip?
Officially, two things. First, reaffirm the U.S. commitment to Israeli security. Standard stuff. Second, coordinate a shared strategy on the war in Gaza. Israel calls it Operation Gideon's Chariots II. And also, coordinate opposition to recognizing a Palestinian state unilaterally at the upcoming UN General Assembly.
Okay, so that's the official line. What did we actually see him do while he was there, given that diplomatic tightrope?
Well, on the 14th and 15th, Rubio joined Netanyahu for a very public tour. They went to the Western Wall and the archaeological tunnels right next to it. This was highly symbolic, like meticulously planned to reinforce Jewish historical claims to Jerusalem, definitely resonate with the administration's evangelical base,
yeah,
and send a really clear message of strong support for Israel.
A very public show of solidarity then, especially after the president's comments. What about the private talks? Were they trying to smooth things over after that Qatar strike?
That was definitely part of it, yeah. Privately, the meetings were aimed at managing that fallout, conveying U.S. strategic concerns. It really represents what you might call a carefully calibrated diplomatic performance, like a dual-track strategy. Balancing that ideological alignment with strategic flexibility. It lets the U.S. keep the alliance strong while still having room to apply pressure if an ally's actions, you know, clash with broader U.S. interests,
yeah,
like regional stability. Mm. This approach, it kind of shows how the administration tries to navigate these complex relationships, projecting strength and solidarity in public, but doing some delicate negotiating behind closed doors to prevent things from getting worse.
So what does this kind of balancing act mean for peace efforts in the region? Are they just treading water? And how does it affect America's standing globally?
Well, this dual track thing means the U.S. is walking a very, very fine line, trying to back its ally, Israel, but also trying to prevent actions that could, you know, further destabilize the Middle East or alienate other partners like Qatar. For peace efforts, it means things remain incredibly fragile, really dependent on intense, sometimes kind of contradictory diplomacy. America's standing could go either way, right? It
yeah.
might look like savvy engagement on multiple fronts, managing complex alliances, or it could look inconsistent, depending on how these balancing acts actually play out. Every little move, public or private, carries a lot of weight.
Okay, let's move on to major agency actions. The Department of Justice, the DOJ, made a really significant move on September 12th. Targeting the gig economy through civil rights law.
Yeah, this is the big one, a landmark legal action.
Yeah.
The DOJ filed a lawsuit against Uber, alleging systemic violations of the Americans with Disabilities Act, the ADA, and they're seeking serious damages, $125 million. The suit claims Uber drivers routinely discriminate against passengers with disabilities, refusing service if they have service animals or stowable wheelchairs, charging illegal fees, not providing reasonable accommodations.
And this isn't Uber's first time dealing with something like this, right?
Yep. It follows a settlement back in 2022 over discriminatory wait time fees they were charging disabled passengers.
So $125 million against Uber, that definitely gets attention. What's the DOJ really aiming for here beyond the money? And what does this mean for the whole gig economy model?
It's potentially profound. The DOJ, under Assistant Attorney General Harmeet Dhillon, is basically using a well-established civil rights law to assert federal control over how these platform companies operate. If they win, it could force fundamental changes at Uber. Driver training, accountability, maybe even their whole operational model. And more broadly, it sets a powerful precedent. Other gig economy companies could be held liable for discrimination too.
So it's a way to regulate without new legislation.
Exactly. It underscores a strategic shift. Instead of waiting for Congress, which can be slow, the DOJ is using existing law to force corporate accountability fast. It's like they're becoming an agile regulator for this fast-moving digital economy. For you, this could really shape the future of worker rights and consumer protections online, forcing these platforms to make sure their services are actually accessible to everyone.
Okay, next up, the Treasury Department, announcing a major shift in how federal benefits get paid out. Firm deadline, September 30th, 2025. It's all about mandating digital payments.
That's right. Treasury confirmed they're phasing out paper checks for most federal benefits. Social Security, veterans payments, the works. This wraps up Executive Order 14247, modernizing payments to and from America's bank account, which came out back in March. So everyone getting federal benefits will need to switch to either direct deposit or a Treasury-sponsored debit card, the Direct Express MasterCard.
And the official reason for this big change, efficiency, security.
That's the line. Reduce fraud, theft, payment delays. The Treasury Secretary called it a long-standing bipartisan goal. So on the surface, yeah, it's about making government finances more efficient and secure.
But like any big top-down change, there've got to be potential downsides, right? What about folks who aren't easily plugged into the digital banking world?
That's the crucial question. It's a fundamental modernization. Promises gains for the government, sure. But this push for technocratic efficiency, it comes with real potential costs. It creates significant hurdles for vulnerable groups. Think about the elderly, people in rural areas with spotty internet, the unbanked. They might lack the tech, the financial know-how, or even just trust in banks to navigate this.
And how is the government helping people make this switch?
Well, their mitigation strategy seems to be providing phone numbers and website links for help, which, you know, kind of puts the burden of figuring it out squarely on the individual. This shift could accidentally create new barriers for people trying to access essential benefits. Someone in a remote area without a bank account or reliable internet, they might struggle to get their Social Security. It could lead to payment disruptions, or worse, push people towards predatory financial services. For you, it's a stark reminder, isn't it? Efficiency gains for the government don't always mean equitable access for everyone. Sometimes they create new problems for those least able to adapt.
Let's turn to public health now. The Department of Health and Human Services, HHS, and that controversial Make Our Children Healthy Again, or MAHA, strategy report came out September 8th, but it's still making waves.
Oh, definitely. This report, developed under HHS Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr., it's really sweeping, outlines over 120 initiatives aimed at reversing childhood chronic disease. And the proposals are, well, both ambitious and really controversial. Targeting ultra-processed foods, calling to close the GRES loophole that's generally recognized as safe for food additives, and significantly emphasizing vaccine injury investigation while also preserving patient and provider choice on vaccination schedules.
So a vision for public health that's definitely generating debate. How has the mainstream medical community reacted, especially given the administration's stance on some of these issues?
Deeply divided, is putting it mildly. The AMA, the American Medical Association, said they'd monitor how it's implemented, but reaffirmed their commitment to vaccine access and pushed back against misinformation. But others, like the American Academy of Pediatrics, AAP, and the American Psychiatric Association, APA, they were much more critical. They pointed out the report ignores key threats, like gun violence. And they noted it came out just as Medicaid funding was being cut and anti-vaccine sentiment was rising.
So it sounds like a real ideological clash.
It really signifies a major ideological shift in federal public health policy. It's using the authority of HHS to push a narrative that often challenges the scientific consensus of mainstream medical groups, framing public health issues as this struggle against corporate capture.
That's a loaded term, corporate capture. What are the risks of politicizing public health like this? Is there any common ground possible here?
Well, the big risk is eroding public trust in agencies like the CDC and FDA, turning them into battlegrounds for competing ideologies instead of, you know, trusted sources of objective science. Whether there's middle ground, that's the critical question. This report directly challenges established consensus in many areas. It creates this profound split between the administration's approach and that of major medical organizations. This is definitely a crucial area to watch. It affects every family's approach to health and fundamentally changes how people might view the role and authority of federal health agencies.
Okay, shifting gears slightly. While all this domestic policy is unfolding, the Department of Defense held a big public event over the weekend, the Joint Base Andrews Air Show, September 13th and 14th.
Yeah, it drew huge crowds from the D.C. area. And it's more than just, you know, cool planes flying around. It functions as a really critical public relations and recruitment tool for the military, showcasing advanced tech, projecting that image of American air power. And the timing was interesting, wasn't it? It provided this domestic backdrop of military strength right when Secretary Rubio was doing that sensitive diplomatic work overseas.
Right.
It's a subtle message, maybe, but powerful in a complex world. Projecting capability at home and abroad, reminding people that military presence isn't just global, it's deeply national too.
And speaking of defense logistics, the Defense Logistics Agency, DLA, is rolling out a pretty ambitious digital strategy. This was reported September 12th, building on an industry event they held earlier. What's pushing DLA towards this digital transformation?
Well, the DLA, they're basically the military's giant supply chain manager, and they're facing a tough situation. Their budget's getting cut yearly, $50 million projected from 2024 to 2026, but their responsibilities are actually growing. So to deal with that, they've laid out these three strategic priorities. They call them the three sets. The goal is to drive efficiency and responsiveness, making sure they can support the troops, especially thinking ahead to potential future conflicts.
Okay, three sets. What are they and how does AI fit into this?
So first is set the agency. That's about transforming the workforce, boosting data skills, and applying artificial intelligence. Second is set the globe, which means empowering logistics where they're needed most and making the industrial base more resilient. And third is set the supply chains, which is all about modernizing their systems. The DLA director, Army LT General Mark Simmerly, he called AI a cornerstone of our digital strategy. They've had like 56 AI models already in development or use, often coming from ideas from their own employees.
A bottom-up approach to AI. Interesting.
Yeah, they're even training employees as citizen developers to empower that. The idea is to get much better at predicting what the military will need, especially for older weapon systems where parts get obsolete and predicted way in advance.
So it's all about making sure the military gets what it needs when it needs it. What does the supply chain modernization part actually involve?
That third set, it focuses on updating 9 different supply chain systems. The goal is to move faster, think smarter, improve data integration. They want this common digital thread so they have visibility all the way from the factory floor to the soldier in the field, you know, from factory to foxhole. And of course, protecting it all from cyber threats. It also targets better inventory management, financial tracking, customer service. They're looking at advanced tech, kind of like what Amazon uses in its fulfillment centers.
So this big digital push is really about countering those budget cuts.
Exactly. Driving efficiency and responsiveness to make sure the U.S. military stays agile and equipped, even with less money to work with. It's about preparing for an increasingly complex global environment.
Staying with defense, the Pentagon is also shaking up its cybersecurity. News reported on September 12th suggests big changes to their risk management framework, the RMF.
That's right. Katie Arrington, who's acting as the DOD CIO, she announced the new RMS is coming soon. Basically, the rulebook for managing cyber risks to their systems. And a whole revamped instruction on cybersecurity, DOTI 8500, last updated in 2019, that's set for release by November 30th. So yeah, big changes ahead.
What are the core ideas behind this new RMF? How will it change things like getting software approved?
Key things will include continuous monitoring, updated training requirements for cyber personnel, and a big shift towards using continuous authority to operate, or continuous ATO. This continuous ATO, the idea is to avoid what they call the 2-year valley of death in getting software accredited. Basically, streamline the approval process, cut out months of waiting for new software. They've already got this software fast track initiative, SWFT, that started in April, and it's showing success in speeding things up.
And there's this new concept, Mission Network as a Service. What's that about? How does it affect data sharing?
Yeah, BOD is developing this to basically collapse all these separate mission networks across different commands into secret-level commercial cloud environments. It'll include things like managing identities and access, and crucially, appropriate data label and data tagging. This would let data move dynamically between different security levels, say, from impact level 2 up to top secret based on how sensitive it is. That's a pretty big leap in secure data sharing.
Wow. Yeah.
And just to round it out, that Cybersecurity Maturity Model Certification Program, CMMC, the one that requires defense contractors to meet certain cyber standards. That's finally officially going into effect November 10th.
So what's the bottom line for national security with all these cyber initiatives? Speed and resilience seem key.
Definitely. This is a major overhaul of how DoD handles software approval and network security. It's driven by this urgent need for speed and agility because the cyber threats are constantly changing. The goal is absolutely to make military tech and operations more resilient, more responsive. Being able to securely share info across different classification levels dynamically, that's a huge technological step forward. For you, these are really crucial efforts to protect national security in that digital battle space, making sure our defense systems are not just strong but fast and adaptable enough to counter sophisticated threats.
Okay, elsewhere in the executive branch, the Interior Department is pushing ahead with IT consolidation plans, also reported September 12th. What's happening there?
Yeah, Interior is centralizing its IT operations. IT staff will move into the Office of the Secretary, which means, you know, they won't be directly tackling tech problems specific to bureaus like the National Park Service or BLM or Fish and Wildlife anymore.
Sounds like another push for efficiency from the top. But what are the potential downsides of taking that specialized IT support away from the individual bureaus?
It absolutely looks like an administrative push for efficiency. Follow Secretary Doug Burgum's call a few months back for broader consolidation of back office stuff. But yeah, an employee raised concerns, said it would add to their workload and that hundreds of IT jobs might become redundant, potentially at risk. It really highlights that tension, doesn't it, between the administrative goal of efficiency and the potential hit to morale, and maybe more importantly, the specialized support that these diverse bureaus really need. Can centralized efficiency really serve the unique needs of a huge department like Interior? That's the question.
Also on September 12th, the U.S. Coast Guard headquarters got reorganized. What's the aim of this structural shuffle?
Basically, they stood up a new office, the Office of Coordination, Programming, and Accountability. Captain Nick Simmons is leading it. This new office takes over everything the old Office of Budget and Programs used to do. So formulating the budget, making sure programs align with the Coast Guard strategic direction, coordinating external reporting. The goal seems to be ensuring the Coast Guard's programs and budgets line up more directly with the administration's priorities. It's part of that ongoing effort we're seeing to streamline agencies, align them more closely with executive directives, aiming for, you know, tighter control, greater accountability, clearer strategic coherence.
The acting Federal Chief Information Security Officer, Mike Duffy, also laid out his top priorities earlier this week, reported on the 12th. What's top of mind for him in federal cybersecurity?
Yeah, Mike Duffy, the acting federal CISO, he outlined three main priorities for the Federal CISO Council for the next year. One, enterprise cyber defense. Two, operational resilience. Three, securing federal transaction services. He said enterprise cyber defense needs a new way of thinking, focusing on vulnerability management, supply chain security, incident response, but treating all agencies as part of one larger enterprise. They're planning a tabletop exercise on operational resilience soon. And securing transactions, you know, the interfaces between the government and citizens. That's fundamentally about protecting your data when you interact with federal websites or services.
So really trying to view federal cybersecurity as a whole, not just agency by agency. What's the bigger picture there?
These priorities, they really highlight this concerted effort to strengthen the government's cyber posture beyond just individual agencies, viewing federal operations as this single interconnected enterprise. And the emphasis on operational resilience, securing those citizen-facing transactions, that shows a recognition of the real-world impact cyber threats can have on government services and public trust. For you, it means a focused effort to protect your data and make sure federal services stay reliable in this increasingly tricky digital world. They know a breach anywhere can affect everywhere.
Okay, and finally for the executive branch this week, a big overhaul of the Federal Acquisition Regulation, the FAR, four revamped sections released September 12th, comments due October 27th, and there's a significant change in how contracts get selected.
Yes, this is a major move to simplify and modernize federal acquisition. That's how the government buys stuff. OFPP and the FAR Council released updates to four more parts. Part 3 on conflicts of interest, Part 17 on special contracting methods, Part 27 on patents and data rights, and Part 45 on government property, mostly focused on streamlining, simplifying the language, getting rid of outdated stuff. They've now revised 37 out of the 53 total FAR sections. So it's a big undertaking.
But there's one specific change about contract selection that seems really important, right? Could really change how businesses work with the government.
That's the key thing here. An update back on August 29th, the FAR 8.104, which deals with using existing contracts. It got rid of any reference to best-in-class contracts as being, you know, required use. Instead, FAR 8.104 sets up a new category of required use contracts. It directs agencies to use existing government-wide contracts or blanket purchase agreements, BPAs, that OFPP designates as required use, unless they get an exception.
Why is dropping best-in-class significant?
Well, that best-in-class system was often seen as really bureaucratic. It led to a lot of duplicate contracts, which made it harder, especially for smaller businesses, to compete effectively.
So what are the hoped-for outcomes of this shift? Is it just about efficiency or something more?
The goal is definitely to simplify and modernize federal buying, make it more efficient, more adaptable. Getting rid of best-in-class and having clear required use contracts, that's meant to cut down on unnecessary duplication, leverage government and commercial buying power better, encourage more market discipline when agencies plan acquisitions, and hopefully provide more efficient business opportunities for companies, especially small businesses. It's not just efficiency, though. It's kind of a strategic move. Using government purchasing power to influence the market, create more competition, while trying to streamline what was often a real bureaucratic mess. It's being called a common sense approach. The potential is there to deliver better mission support for the American people by opening things up while standardizing the process.
Okay, so we've seen the executive branch really driving policy through mandates, strategic actions. Now let's pivot to the legislative branch. Congress is starting to react, sometimes pushing back, sometimes supporting, and setting its own agenda. And this past week saw some big moves, starting with the Senate changing its rules September 11th and 12th to speed up nominee confirmations.
Yeah, this is the latest shot fired in this long, like 12-year gradual process where both parties have chipped away at the filibuster, making the nominations game much more partisan. Senate Republicans pushed forward with a party-line vote 45-53. The Majority Leader, John Thune, he said the Democrats' obstruction was unsustainable, and the goal was to restore the longtime Senate precedent of expeditious confirmation, whatever that means now.
Right. So what does this new rule actually do? How does it affect the president getting his team in place?
This proposal, it lets the Senate move some of Trump's nominees through in big batches, groups of 48 at a time. Specifically, we're talking undersecretaries, various agency staff positions, a number of ambassadors. Now, they explicitly stop short of speeding up votes for top cabinet officials or lifetime judges. Republicans still need a few more procedural steps next week to finalize it, but the first big group could potentially get confirmed as soon as next Thursday.
And the Democrats' position?
Well, Democrats, led by Chuck Schumer, they've blocked more nominees than ever before. They argue Trump's picks are historically bad, you know, woefully unqualified, unscrupulous, deeply dishonest. Negotiations just broke down completely, which led to this rule change.
So what does this mean for the Senate as an institution? The balance of power, the minority's ability to influence things?
Well, Democrats warn the Republicans, you'll come to regret this, which, you know, we've heard before from both sides when these rules change. This specific change, it's designed to give the president more power to, as the Democrats put it, rubber stamp whomever he wants, whenever he wants them, no questions asked. It definitely reduces the minority's ability to delay these lower level but still important appointments. For you, it just highlights these ongoing partisan battles and how they directly affect how the government gets staffed and functions. It really underscores that diminishing power of the minority to act as a check on presidential appointments for a whole swath of federal jobs.
Okay, now let's look at Congress coming back fully this week, scheduled for today, September 15th. The House was adjourned till noon. Senate convenes at 3 p.m. What are the big priorities?
Right, they're back to a full schedule, setting the stage for some critical debates. The Senate's main item right now, pending business, is the National Defense Authorization Act, the NDAA, for fiscal year 2026.
Ah, the NDAA. Always a huge piece of legislation, right? It ends up being about much more than just the military budget.
Oh, absolutely. It's considered must-pass every single year. Authorizes the budget, sets key policies for the Defense Department, but because it has to pass, it becomes this legislative Christmas tree, you know, a vehicle for all sorts of policy debates and amendments, stuff ranging from foreign aid to presidential war powers, military social policies, you name it. The whole debate and passage, it's like a microcosm of the larger national security discussion. Factions in both parties try to attach their priorities. The final bill. It's always a negotiated settlement, makes it a really crucial barometer of the power dynamics, both between the branches and within Congress itself. This is where major national security decisions get locked into law, often after some intense bargaining.
Also on the defense front, we heard from Marine Corps General Christopher Mahoney. He's a pick for vice chairman of the Joint Chiefs. His confirmation hearing was September 11th, reported the 12th, and he called for end-to-end reform of the Pentagon's requirements process.
Yeah, this is potentially huge for defense spending and getting new tech out there. General Mahoney told senators that the Pentagon's Joint Requirements Oversight Council, the JROC, needs a complete overhaul. The JROC is this high-level group that's supposed to validate military requirements for big acquisition programs. But he pointed to GAO findings, the Government Accountability Office, saying JROC's review, which should take maybe 100 days, often drags on for over 800 days.
Wow, 800 days, that's a massive delay.
Huge bottleneck, yeah. Really slows down getting new capabilities to the troops.
So what's the plan to fix this? What are the proposed reforms?
Well, the Senate's 2026 defense bill, it includes something called the Forged Act, F-O-R-G-E-D, Fostering Reform in Government Efficiency and Defense. It aims to totally redefine JROC's mission, shift it away from just reviewing paperwork, make it more strategic, focused on future needs. This new role would involve looking at global threats, shaping future force design, working with commanders to prioritize problems, constantly assessing capabilities, identifying gaps, new tech, commercial solutions, new concepts. And critically, the bill would actually strip JROC of its power to approve service level requirements and major acquisition milestones. push that authority down to the services themselves.
So really changing how military gear gets developed and bought, what did General Mahoney think of these reforms, and what could this mean for defense procurement overall?
Mahoney strongly backed the Senate's plan. He said he wants DOD to embrace a fundamental reorientation of the Joint Requirements Oversight Council and overhaul of the joint requirements process. He kept stressing end-to-end reform, connecting requirements to resources, saying, "Those three things are often treated as separate pillars. I believe they're a system, and if you don't treat them as a system, you're going to break down somewhere."
Makes sense.
He also pointed to recommendations from the PPPE Reform Commission. That's planning, programming, budgeting, and execution. Things like using operations and maintenance funds over multiple years, protections against budget uncertainty from continuing resolutions, higher thresholds for moving money around. The whole reform effort, it aims to slash bureaucracy, speed things up, and improve the quality with the military buys. It's really critical to keep the U.S. military agile, equipped for future challenges, given how fast global threats are changing. That focus on thinking systemically, requirements, acquisition, resources, all linked, could dramatically boost efficiency and effectiveness in defense spending. Get better stuff to the troops faster.
Okay, looking at committee activities, today, September 15th, is just packed with hearings. It really feels like a roadmap, showing where Congress might support the president and where they plan to push back or investigate.
Exactly. It's where a lot of the detailed work happens. For instance, the House Veterans Affairs Subcommittee on Tech Modernization. They have an oversight hearing at 3 p.m. on advancing VA care through artificial intelligence. That ties right into those executive pushes for AI we talked about, like at DLA. Then the House Rules Committee meets at 4 p.m. They're looking at several bills, including energy ones like H.R. 2047, the Guaranteeing Reliability Through the Interconnection of Dispatchable Power Act, and H.R. 3015, the National Coal Council Reestablishment Act. Those directly support the administration's deregulatory energy agenda. And that same rules meeting includes a bunch of bills targeting crime in D.C., mirroring those recent executive orders about ending cashless bail there.
So some clear alignment with the White House agenda there. But what about areas where Congress might be looking to challenge the executive branch? Where's the friction?
That's where it gets interesting. Yeah. The House Judiciary Committee, holding an oversight of the Federal Bureau of Investigation hearing at 10 a.m. That's a prime platform for lawmakers to scrutinize the FBI, maybe challenge administration narratives. Similarly, the Senate HLP Committee, Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions, they have a 10 a.m. hearing to review recent events at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention and implications for children's health. That's going to dive right into those controversial debates around the MAHA report we discussed, signals clear congressional scrutiny of the administration's public health policies.
And there are financial hearings scheduled, too, keeping an eye on the economy.
Right. House Financial Services Subcommittee on Housing and Insurance is looking at reauthorizing the Terrorism Risk Insurance Act at 10 a.m., and their task force is discussing monetary policy, treasury markets, and economic prosperity at 2 p.m. This whole packed committee schedule, it really does reveal those specific areas of potential synergy, but also potential friction between the branches. It's not just about passing laws. It's Congress asserting its role in shaping policy, holding the executive accountable, and laying the groundwork for future legislative fights and oversight battles.
We also have a really pressing issue with cybersecurity legislation. Congress needs to act before the end of September. This was flagged in commentary published on the 12th.
Yeah, this is genuinely urgent. Frank Salufo, he's the director of the Macquarie Institute for Cyber and Critical Infrastructure Security. He put out a stark warning, talked about China's The Typhoons campaign. This campaign, he says, involves embedding malware inside critical U.S. infrastructure, breaking into 9 of the biggest U.S. phone networks, targeting 80 nations to steal data. Really serious stuff.
Yeah.
And Congress is basically until the end of this month, September, to stop 2 key pillars of America's cyber defense from collapsing. One is the Cybersecurity Information Sharing Act, CISA, from 2015. The other is the State and Local Cybersecurity Grant Program.
Okay, CISA 2015, what happens if that's not renewed? What are the immediate consequences for cyber defense?
CISA, it's 10 years old now. It's what enabled private companies to share real-time threat info with federal agencies during an attack. It did that by giving them liability protections and privacy safeguards. Without it, companies will likely hesitate to share that vital intelligence. Attacks might go unreported. Intrusions could spread faster. It would set the U.S. cyber posture back a decade, honestly. CISA's framework, it's seen as the backbone of our cyber defense because it builds that trust needed for government and the private sector to work together.
And the State and Local Cybersecurity Grant Program, how important is that funding for, say, smaller towns or counties.
Hugely important. This program was set up to provide $1 billion. According to the GAO, it's already funding almost 840 cybersecurity projects across 33 states. These investments are crucial. Upgrading old IT systems, developing cyber policies, hiring needed staff, especially for smaller jurisdictions that just don't have the budget otherwise and really rely on this funding to protect essential services.
So the stakes are pretty high if these aren't renewed.
Extremely high. Losing visibility into these fast-moving threats would be, as Salufo put it, reckless, especially when adversaries are ramping up their campaigns. Information sharing is one of the few ways defenders can actually keep pace with attackers. There is bipartisan support and committee to extend CISACE's liability protections for another 10 years, led by Chairman Garbarino. And Sean Plankey, Trump's nominee to lead the CISA agency, also voiced strong support. But Congress needs to act. The whole idea is that security is a shared responsibility. Congress has to make sure the private sector and state and local governments have the ammunition they need to win. This directly impacts the safety and resilience of critical services right across the country, things like power grids, hospitals, emergency communications.
Okay, let's shift to the judicial branch. The Supreme Court made a significant move with that emergency stay on IC's enforcement. The case is Noam v. Vasquez Perdomo, issued September 8th, but the impact is ongoing, reported today, the 15th.
Yeah, this is a prime example of the power of the Supreme Court's emergency docket. People often call it the shadow docket because these decisions happen fast without the full arguments and opinions, but they can have immediate widespread policy impact. In this case, a lower court, a U.S. district court, had put an injunction in place. It stopped ICI officers in the L.A. area from doing investigative stops based on things like where someone was day laborer sites, for instance, what kind of work they did, language they spoke, or apparent ethnicity. The Supreme Court then stepped in and issued a stay, pausing that lower court's injunction.
So what's the immediate practical effect of the Supreme Court stepping in like that? Does ICE get the green light to resume those tactics right away?
Yes, exactly. This action immediately allows ICE to go back to using those contested enforcement tactics while the main case works its way through the full appeal process. It really highlights the immense power of that emergency docket to shape national policy very quickly, often without the benefit of full briefings or oral arguments that you get in regular cases.
Yeah.
And what's interesting here is the dynamic. The judiciary didn't just check executive power. It actually intervened to remove an obstacle put up by a lower court, effectively enabling the executive's policy to move forward. It kind of demonstrates how the court's current makeup can proactively help achieve the policy goals of a philosophically aligned executive branch. It alters that traditional view of checks and balances a bit. This case is definitely part of the larger legal battles over the administration's pretty aggressive immigration agenda and the scope of executive power.
Okay, another important judicial decision came late Friday, September 12th, or maybe early the 13th, reported on the 13th. This one involved the Office of Personnel Management, OPM, and mass firings. Sounds like a win for federal employee unions, even if people aren't getting their jobs back immediately.
That's right. A federal judge in San Francisco, Judge William Alsup, he found that OPM acted unlawfully when it directed agencies to fire probationary federal employees en masse. He said OPM exceeded its own powers and directed agencies to fire under false pretense. This was back in mid-February when OPM told agencies to terminate about 25,000 probationary employees, claiming it was for poor performance.
Which agencies does this ruling cover? And what does it signal about OPM's role versus individual agencies?
It applies to Commerce, Defense, HHS, Labor, Treasury, Transportation, and Agriculture. OPM itself, NASA, State Department, and OMB are exempt. The ruling basically says OPM overstepped. They created this standardized, potentially pretextual reason for firing people, instead of letting each agency make its own decision based on the law and the individual circumstances.
So the judge found the firings were unlawful, but what about the employees themselves? Does this ruling mean they get reinstated?
That's the critical piece here. The ruling does not reinstate any of the fired employees. Judge Alsup pointed to a July Supreme Court decision that gave the Trump administration broad authority to reshape and shrink the federal workforce. He also acknowledged that reinstatement probably wouldn't provide much relief anyway, since the terminated employees had likely moved on and the agencies had transformed.
So what does the ruling do for those employees?
It directs the affected agencies to update personnel records by November 14th. They had to specify that these employees were not fired for poor performance or misconduct, and they had to send letters to the impacted employees stating this. So it addresses the harm of that pretextual termination. It clears their records, which is huge for future employment prospects. The judge also clarified his order doesn't stop agencies from firing employees in the future, as long as the agency makes its own decision and follows the law, without just using an OPM template. It's a significant legal victory for employee rights and unions, even without reinstatement. Provides clarity, clears names.
Okay, moving into workforce reforms and challenges, OPM is making another big move. A final rule on performance ratings for the senior executive service, the SES, scheduled for publication today, September 15th.
Yeah. This new rule officially lifts a ban on using a forced distribution system for career SES members. The SES, that's the top tier of career federal employees, basically the government's senior management corps. This system, in practice, it will cap how many SES members an agency can rate at the top two levels out of five, levels four and five. So a certain percentage must fall into the lower categories, levels one, two, or three, regardless of how well they actually performed individually. Creates intense competition for those top ratings. OPM's justification is that this will hold agencies and SES members to a higher standard of accountability, making sure only the truly deserving performers are rewarded.
Why the change now? What was wrong with the old system, according to OPM?
Well, OPM criticized the old system because in 2023, something like 96% of SES members got top ratings. They argue this undermined the integrity of the ratings, made it impossible to tell who the real top performers were. Now, importantly, OPM did revise its initial proposal. They decided to exclude political appointees from these forced distribution requirements. That addressed a big concern that agencies might prioritize political folks over career SES members for those limited high ratings, basically protecting career staff from getting unfairly pushed down.
Okay, so a forced curve for career execs, but not politicals. How is this being received? It sounds like it could really impact morale and how people approach their jobs.
Yeah, reception is mixed. Supporters think the current ratings are inflated and forced distribution will improve agency performance by increasing accountability. Critics, though, they warn it'll hurt agency culture, maybe stifle innovation. They argue it could make reviews less accurate or lead to executives just playing it safe to avoid getting a lower rating. OPM argues it will actually improve culture and accuracy, saying a level 3 rating will now be increasingly recognized as a positive rating. We'll see. The final rule also strips out any parts of performance reviews that assess senior executives based on diversity, equity, and inclusion that's been a priority for the Trump administration.
And this fits into a broader pattern, right?
Definitely. It follows guidance from June telling agencies to rate fewer employees highly and discipline poor performers quickly, promising bigger awards for the truly top performers. And back in February, OPM updated SES standards to make adhering to the president's policies the most critical element of their reviews.
Hmm.
So yeah, this is a significant cultural and structural shift, emphasizing accountability and political alignment over other metrics. It will undoubtedly impact morale, career paths, and how decisions get made within agencies.
Okay, let's turn to federal retirement and Social Security. Several important updates reported on September 12th. First, OPM is bracing for a wave of retirement applications.
That's the word. OPM is expecting the retirement application backlog to potentially double. This is because of a wave of applications coming from VERA, Voluntary Early Retirement Authority, where they offer incentives to retire early, and the DRP, the Deferred Resignation Program, where people resign but stay on for a bit longer. To cope, OPM is rolling out a new online retirement application system. Applications will go electronically from HR and payroll straight to OPM instead of through the mail.
Will this new online system actually help speed things up for retirees waiting for their benefits?
It should speed up the front end, yeah.
Yeah.
Make submissions more complete, more accurate, hopefully. But delays are still expected for the complex cases. Things like divorces where benefits have to be split, or calculating contributions that weren't paid or got refunded, those still take time. OPM is suggesting instant certification might be possible for clean cases, which could mean quicker initial payments for some. Tammy Flanagan, she's a retirement specialist. Her advice to employees is basically expect the best and prepare for the worst. She really stressed making sure your official personnel folder, your EOPF, has a clear documented history of your whole federal career to avoid delays.
Good advice. So for you listening, if you're a Fed planning retirement, meticulous records are absolutely key right now.
Crucial.
There were also some common myths about federal retirement benefits busted in an article on September 12th. Let's hit a few of those. First big one. When does retirement pay actually start?
Yeah, the big myth is it starts right away. The reality. Your agency doesn't even send your retirement package to OPM until your official retirement date. Then OPM starts processing, which can take up to 90 days. Retirees usually get interim pay, maybe 60, 80% of their actual annuity within 2 or 3 months. So not immediate.
Okay. What about the Thrift Savings Plan, the TSP? Is that all you need?
Another myth. Reality is, retirement income usually comes from three legs of the stool: your pension, Social Security, and your TSP. The TSP is meant to bridge the gap. And there are different ways to take money out. It's often recommended to consider rolling some or all of your TSP into a private sector IRA or Roth IRA. It gives you more flexibility and is tax and penalty free to do the transfer.
What about health benefits and life insurance after retirement? Big worries for people.
Definitely. Myth. Your FEHB, federal employee health benefits, goes away or gets way more expensive. Fact. FEHB can continue into retirement if you meet the rules, like being enrolled for the 5 consecutive years before you retire and having it on your retirement date. And the government keeps paying its share, about 72% of the premium. You can also enroll in Medicare A and B, then Medicare becomes primary, FEHB secondary.
And life insurance, FEGI.
Myth, the price stays the same.
Yeah.
Back. Basic FEGL is cheap while you're working, but the cost jumps dramatically in retirement, depending on which options you chose. Basic, option A, B, C. You really need to understand your specific plan and how those costs escalate.
And survivor benefits, often misunderstood and critical for spouses.
Huge one. Myths. Survivor benefits are automatic and free, and spouses automatically keep FEHB. Fact. You have to elect survivor benefits on your retirement application. And it costs something. A percentage deducted from your pension each month differs between FERS and the older CSRS system. And here's the critical part. FEHB stops for survivors if no survivor benefit was elected. Any amount of survivor benefit continues the health insurance. It's absolutely essential for people nearing retirement to talk to a federal retirement consultant. Look at the whole picture. This isn't automatic, and it has massive consequences for surviving spouses.
Okay, shifting to Social Security, an interview with Tammy Flanagan on September 12th busted some myths there too. What's the biggest one about collecting Social Security while still working?
The biggest myth is that you simply can't collect Social Security if you're still working. Fact is, that earnings limit, the one that stops or reduces benefits if you earn too much, it goes away completely once you reach your full retirement age. For most people now, that's somewhere close to 67. So lots of people in their late 60s, early 70s who are still working could have been collecting benefits for years and maybe didn't even realize it.
Interesting. What about spousal benefits?
Another myth. Spousal benefits are only for survivors. Fact. Spousal benefits can be paid while both spouses are still alive. Key things when deciding when to claim. There's that 8-year window from age 62 up to 70. If you wait past your full retirement age, say 67 up to age 70, you get delayed retirement credits, boosting your benefit by 8% per year. But the decision should really depend on personal circumstances. Do you need the money now? Family needs. Or maybe wait as a hedge against longevity, you know, to avoid outliving your savings.
Are there resources to help figure this out?
Social Security's website is great. You can get your personal benefit statement, use their calculators. The break-even point, or the total amount you receive, ends up roughly the same no matter when you started claiming. That's often around age 81 or 82.
And there was a recent law change affecting Social Security for some federal retirees, right?
Yes, the Social Security Fairness Act. Passed January 5th this year, it eliminated the Windfall Elimination Provision, WEP, and the Government Pension Offset, GPO. WEP used to reduce Social Security benefits for people who also got a pension from work not covered by Social Security, like many CSRS federal retirees. GPO reduced spousal or survivor benefits for those people. So this means CSRS retirees, who might not have qualified for Social Security before, would have gotten much less, could now potentially get their own benefits or a portion of a spouse's or widow's benefit. Big change for them.
Wow. So all these discussions, the changes, they really highlight significant shifts in federal employment, retirement planning. OPM's trying to modernize, but facing hurdles. Misconceptions about benefits persist. Legislative changes open new doors. It's a complex landscape.
It really is. For you listening, especially if you're a federal employee or retiree, it means navigating a lot of changes, benefits, performance standards, job security. Being proactive and informed can literally pay off.
Okay, this past week also saw some controversy around IRS hiring, described as a bait and switch for seasonal hires, reported September 12th. What's the story and what could it mean for taxpayers come filing season?
Yeah, the IRS changed its hiring plans for customer service staff for the next tax season. Back in July, they'd posted, then pulled, notices for 4,500 full-time jobs. Now, the new plan is to hire just over 2,150 frontline customer service positions, but over 70% of those will be seasonal hires. They can only stay on the job for a maximum of 4 years. Hiring events are happening now, and they're only filling about 600 full-time supervisor and lead positions, and those are only open to internal candidates.
How did the union react to this? especially the shift to mostly seasonal, term-limited jobs.
Leaders at a regional chapter of the NTEU, the National Treasury Employees Union, they called it a bait and switch, plain and simple. They argue these term appointments usually don't count towards career tenure. That limits employee rights, job security, chances for advancement. If someone goes from a permanent job to a term job, they give up significant protections.
Is the IRS hiring faster now, at least?
They're using direct hire authority, aiming to make decisions in 40 to 45 days, which is less than half the typical time. They need that speed to staff up for tax season.
What's the bigger picture with the IRS workforce, though? Aren't they facing cuts and budget issues? This seems like a constant struggle.
Huge struggle. The IRS has lost over a quarter of its workforce recently. Layoffs, early retirements, deferred resignations. Over 8,600 taxpayer service employees, that's 20% of that staff, have left. They're actually reinstating 700 who took deferred resignation offers. And budget-wise, they asked for over $850 million in the FY26 budget just to hire 11,000 call center reps to keep phone service at current levels. They warned without them, they'd only answer maybe 16% of calls.
Wow. Do they get the money?
Nope. The House Appropriations Committee advanced its spending bill without those funds. In fact, they proposed deeper overall IRS... October 15th, but the IRS freeze is indefinite, basically until someone decides it's in the national interest to lift it. And on top of all that, they're scrambling to prepare for major tax code changes from the Big Beautiful Bill.
So this shift to seasonal hires, workforce cuts, funding challenges, it sounds like a perfect storm for taxpayer service problems.
It raises serious concerns, yeah, about the IRS's ability to provide adequate service. Could mean delays, longer waits for you during the next filing season. It really highlights that tension between the administrative goal of shrinking the federal workforce and the actual practical demands of running an agency like the IRS. Directly impacts every single taxpayer.
In another labor development, unions were pushing the Veterans Affairs Department, the VA, to restore collective bargaining rights. A deadline expired on September 12th.
Right. A coalition of unions representing VA workers made a final appeal to the VA secretary, urging the department to restore those rights before the deadline hit. That deadline came from a recent Trump executive order, which gave both VA and the Defense Department a window where they could potentially restore collective bargaining for their employees. The unions argued in their letter that taking away those rights has interfered with mission delivery and decimated employee morale.
So what's the significance of this?
It really highlights that ongoing tension, doesn't it? Between the administration's broader goals for managing the federal workforce and the concerns of federal unions about rights, conditions, and ultimately how effectively they can do their jobs, the outcome here will set a precedent for labor relations in these critical federal agencies.
Okay, and finally, let's look at workplace safety funding. OSHA and NIOSH reported September 12th. What's the situation with funding for these agencies, and how is Congress involved?
Well, the Trump administration's proposed 2026 budget included dramatic cuts to OSHA, Occupational Safety and Health Administration, the ones who set and enforce workplace safety rules, and NIOSH, the National Institute for Occupational Safety and Health, which does the research. But the Senate Appropriations Committee pushed back. They reversed most of those cuts in their 2026 Labor HHS appropriations bill. Lorraine Martin, CEO of the National Safety Council, she really emphasized how critical both OSHA and NIOSH are for worker safety. Praised their collaboration guidance, compliance help from OSHA, research on risks and solutions from NIOSH.
What was the administration's reason for proposing the cuts? And what are the arguments against cutting funding now?
The administration framed the cuts as searching for efficiencies, retiring outdated regulations. Martin acknowledged, yeah, some regulations could probably be updated or retired. But she stressed safety has to be the top priority, not just throwing out regulations to throw out regulations. She pointed to key risks. Things involving high energy, gravity, falls, motor vehicles, those cause 37% of workplace fatalities. Plus new tech challenges, AI, automation, robotics. She mentioned lockout to gout, the procedure for making sure machines are safely off before maintenance, as one rule needing an update for new tech.
And the opioid crisis is also a workplace safety issue now, isn't it? It requires a different kind of thinking.
Absolutely. Martin highlighted that. Said 75% of employees report being impacted by opioids somehow, but less than 20% feel their workplace is prepared. She's advocating for naloxone, Narcan availability and training in all workplaces, including federal buildings, seeing it as basic emergency response like having AEDs or fire extinguishers. The National Safety Council is also working on industry consensus standards, trying to bring those to the government as a faster way to update safety practices.
So Congress restoring the funding is significant.
It signals they recognize the vital role these agencies play. But the whole debate, it underscores that challenge, balancing efficiency mandates with the absolute necessity of worker safety. And the focus on emerging risks, like AI and opioids, shows how workplace hazards are evolving, demanding adaptable safety measures. As Martin put it, now really is not the time to dismantle what has been keeping workers safe over decades.
Okay, Sam. So wrapping up this deep dive into federal actions since September 10th, it's been quite a week. What are the big takeaways for you? What stands out?
What really struck me is just the sheer volume of activity, you know, especially from the executive branch, really driving its agenda hard. Through diplomacy, those aggressive legal actions like the Uber suit and these significant, sometimes pretty controversial reforms to how agencies work, how the workforce is managed. But we also see Congress starting to engage more actively now they're back, getting ready for big legislative fights like the NDAA, but also stepping up with critical oversight hearings. It feels like a period of really high tempo governing. Lots of pressure internally and externally.
Right. It's definitely not like the branches are working in isolation. There's this constant interplay. Sometimes they're aligned, sometimes clashing sharply. And it shapes everything from global affairs right down to the structure of the federal workforce, how agencies interact with citizens, and that Supreme Court shadow docket action. A potent reminder of how quickly judicial decisions can shift policy on the ground. Sometimes, like you said, even enabling executive policy, not just checking it, adds another layer to that whole balance of power discussion.
Absolutely. And looking ahead, the next few weeks promise some intense debates over defense policy with the NDAA. Those oversight hearings on the FBI and CDC, they'll definitely test that balance of power, challenge the administration's stories. The DOJ suit against Uber, that could be a real game changer for the digital economy, reshaping consumer rights, corporate accountability, and the fallout from the Middle East policy, that's going to keep unfolding. Global stability really feels like it's hanging in the balance there.
So for you, our listener, here's maybe a provocative thought to chew on as we wrap up. As the federal government pushes hard for what it calls efficiency and modernization everywhere, from digital payments to performance reviews, what's the ultimate cost of this rapid transformation? And who ends up bearing that burden most heavily? Are we building a more responsive government, or maybe just a faster changing one that risks leaving some people behind? Thank you for joining us on The Deep Dive. I'm Alex Johnson.
And I'm Sam Kennedy. Until next time, keep digging deeper.